Hey y'all, how's it going? Oh yeah, I should always start out the show with a good throat clearing. Hey, how's it going? I'm Scott. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Coming up on the show, Eric Margolies will be on to talk about Iraq and Syria. Eric Margolies likes talking about Iraq and Syria. Oh, good. And then, you know, I have another couple of emails out. Hang on one second here. Trying to get Dan McAdams to... Oh. I already emailed him. Let's see if that happens. Yeah, so war. Like I've been telling you for quite a long time now. Yeah, there's going to be another war there. In Iraq. Basically unavoidable. And I don't think Obama really wants to do it. I mean, I'm sure he wouldn't mind sending fleets of drones and all that, but... I think, yeah, it may take a little while for the politics to adjust here in the U.S., but... Well, I just don't see any other consensus on the right other than sending the Marines. I mean, eventually. I guess we'll see, you know, how well the Iraqi army does with Iranian help. But it doesn't seem like they could do anything except protect the areas that are already predominantly Shiite. They're not going to be able to take back Fallujah or Mosul, or any of the other predominantly Sunni areas from the Sunni-based insurgency. And, so, I don't know. But if the Sunni tribal leaders allow the ISIS guys to stay out front and call this, you know, rebellion, this declaration of independence by the Sunni areas of western and northwestern Iraq, if they let that be characterized as the birth of the Islamic State of Iraq along bin Ladenite lines, then the U.S. is going to go to war. They're going to have to send in the Marine. I don't mean have to, like, objectively have to. Like, I'm buying it, or you should buy it. But I'm just saying, under the constraints of American politics, Barack Obama just had a whole extra surge, a whole extra years of war based on the theory that maybe there were 50 or 100 Arabs left in all of Afghanistan. Now he and George Bush have moved the entire jihadi war all the way to the eastern Mediterranean region, and there are thousands of these guys. So there's going to be a war. It's amazing how slow they're going. I guess maybe they thought they could get rid of Assad first before having to turn back this direction, but I don't know. And by the way, this seems like an important point to make about what's going on in Iraq here. This is from the Middle East Monitor. Iraqi Sunni scholars say Iraqi rebels, not ISIS, who face the Iraqi army. MiddleEastMonitor.com. The Association of Muslim Scholars in Iraq said on Friday that describing the rebels who drove the Iraqi army from several cities as operatives of the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant is incorrect. They described the designations as an attempt to abort the uprising in the country. In a statement reported by the Jordanian Asabil newspaper, AMSI said the ISIS label is a clear distortion, which has not changed the reality that Iraqi rebels are the main component of this uprising. Meanwhile, the AMSI also denounced the call by an ISIS spokesman for fighters to head toward Karbala and Najaf. They described that call as irresponsible and objectionable. About the routing of the Iraqi army, the statement said this is an achievement that will infuriate many parties inside and outside Iraq, including those with external agendas that harmed the country for years. Despite claims that it was ISIS who took over the cities and towns, several Iraqi sources have pointed out that tribal rebels, as well as other Iraqi fighters, constitute the main force currently fighting the Iraqi army, in addition to some affiliated to ISIS. Well, I think that there's some truth in that, and obviously some spin, too. It's sort of like all the Tea Party organizations trying to race out and pretend like they supported this guy Bratt in his overthrow of Eric Cantor there in the primaries. Overthrow, is that too polite of a term? Too extreme of one? We helped him do that, they all claimed. Yeah, well, no, you didn't. Kind of a thing. Well, in this case, the ISIS guys came to the fore and scared the hell out of the Iraqi army that turned tail and ran, which has human history ever seen such a thing as a couple of thousand guys, maybe 1,000 guys turning around and scaring off an army of 30,000? I mean, granted, they don't have much to fight for in Mosul or in, Fallujah or any of the cities that are really in uprising against the central government right now, but God dang, 30,000 turn and ran against somewhere between 500 and 2,000 guys. Pretty incredible, and very lightly armed. On the other hand, it is the entire Sunni region. In fact, oh man, see, I got so many different articles here. That ain't it. I don't even know if I have it anymore. What was I just reading this morning about? Man, I can't keep it organized in my head. I read it before the coffee is the problem, I think. About how... Oh, was it this thing by Russ Wellen? In Foreign Policy and Focus? Well, I've been reading it... God dang it, no, that's not it. I don't know what the hell I was reading this morning that was absolutely correct. That was saying that, listen, the Sunni areas of Iraq have really been in a state of uprising since December. They had a massive, peaceful protest movement going on all last summer and fall. And they were attacked repeatedly by Maliki's forces. And then they still kept up the peaceful protests until Maliki came and used force to completely clear the protests. They had their own little Occupy Fallujah going on. And he cracked down on them hard, and that's what finally turned the peaceful movement into a violent one. And I think that this article I was just reading to you is probably right. I mean, when Fallujah's been basically, they threw out their occupying army, 4 or 5 months ago, and have kept it that way. Maliki only responded by shelling them, but couldn't really do anything about it. That really set the precedent, too, that he really doesn't have the ability to hold on to those Sunni territories. But anyway, I think that article I was just reading to you here about what the scholars are saying about how this fight really belongs to the Sunni tribal leaders and the religious authorities and all that is correct. These are the same people who fought the American and Iranian-backed creation of the current government. In the first place, this is the Sunni-based insurgency, and even back then, al-Qaeda in Iraq was a very small percentage. The highest estimates was that they were 7% of the insurgency, something like that. Useful? Why not? If you're a Sunni tribal leader, not necessarily an Islamist or a radical, wouldn't you rather send a bunch of foreigners, a bunch of Saudis and Jordanians and Syrians who've come to fight? Bunch of true believers and put them out front to take the brunt of any pushback by the Iraqi army? And so what if they take credit for a little while? They're not going to get to keep it. You heard in that interview of Mitchell Prothero the other day about how, when he was pointing out, well, Fallujah's been like this for months. And I says, yeah, but they raised their al-Qaeda flag and the tribal leader said, take the flag down. And they took the flag down. In fact, that was pointed out at Pat Lang's blog. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Pat Lang. He's the guy that quoted Admiral Fallon calling General Petraeus an ass-kissing little chicken shit. And he keeps a blog called Six Semper Tyrannis, thus always to tyrants, former DIA and CIA guy, kind of gruff old guy. And that's what he was pointing out back then, too, was that this was really the Sunni-based insurgency, and they're sort of go ahead and let ISIS take the credit as long as they take the brunt of the pushback. Ah, crap. We got to take this break. Right back with more. Eric Margolis coming up. It's the Scott Horn Show.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all his stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state, available at scotthorton.org/Amazon.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. So there's this horrible website called Internet Chronicle, which is supposed to be satire, but it's never funny. All it does is fool people into thinking that their stupid stories are real, which I guess that has value, hoaxing people too. I'm for that. But usually it's not very funny stuff. It's just kind of lame. I don't know. But I read this thing last night that was just, you know, the guy's spit was all over the my side of the screen from the anger and rage as he hammered out this thing. And it was basically just pointing out that America is still backing the rebels in Syria at the same time that the U.S. is calling them the bad guys in Iraq. It's the Iran-Iraq-Syria-Hezbollah alliance against al-Qaeda, and America backs that alliance in Iraq, but backs the Saudis and al-Qaeda in Syria and in Libya. And so there you go. I mean, it's right there in the press. Just put TOW missiles into Google News, and you'll see that the TOW missiles that the Americans are giving to the so-called moderates in Syria are ending up right in the hands of al-Nusra, the Zawahiri-loyal al-Qaeda suicide bombers. And, you know, people keep saying that ISIS got kicked out of al-Qaeda for being too brutal, but that's not true. Al-Qaeda, I mean, does that even sound like it could possibly make sense at all when their entire theory of warfare is to slaughter innocent civilians to provoke overreactions by their enemies? The butchers of New York, the butchers of every damn Shiite marketplace between Baghdad and Basra, from the last decade. That ISIS is too violent? No. The only difference was that the leader of ISIS didn't want to take orders from Zawahiri anymore. And you wonder why. Zawahiri, all he said was, go back to Iraq and stay out of Syria. And maybe part of that was, you're being too brutal and your tactics are counterproductive in Syria. So go back to Iraq. But it was the go back to Iraq that the current leadership of ISIS didn't obey that got them officially denounced by Zawahiri, not their brutality. In fact, if anything, you look at some of these reports. There's a thing in The Atlantic today, which this guy actually, it's that guy, I forgot how to say his name, what his name is. He's kind of a hawkish terrorism expert type, self-appointed terrorism expert type. Yossi Melman, is that it? I think that's who it is. At The Atlantic. But he's saying, hey, look, the ISIS guys really have learned a thing or two from their PR mistakes of the past. And they have a consumer protection office that they've created. That's the title of his article, which is a funny way of saying it. But basically, you know, they're instituting local courts. And they have taken a, you know, I guess execute traitors type of attitude, but go soft on everybody else kind of an attitude. They're trying to not overplay their hand. Now, the problem with them is that, yeah, they're ruthless killers, and everybody hates them, and everybody's going to hate them. They're just too ruthless of killers in the first place. It's like sending the army into the U.S. Army into the Sunni areas of Iraq and saying, yeah, but our guys are such nice guys, and they got Karen Hughes to do public relations for them. So once she's done explaining how this is all in your best interest, then it's going to be great over there. Whatever. No. No, these guys, like the U.S. Army, al-Qaeda carries the seeds of their own worn-out welcome with them wherever they go. Thank goodness for that. But so that's the only reason they got so-called kicked out of al-Qaeda. It was just a power play. And you see that when they decided they wanted to go back to Iraq, not go back to Iraq. Zawahiri or whatever the hell, he really blew it, given an order that he couldn't, compel compliance with. You know, good. The less authority he has, the better. And I don't know about, I don't know. I'll tell you this, though, and here's why I think that there's going to be more war. Because even if Obama really, and even Hillary was saying we shouldn't bomb, although, Rand Paul's already to the right of her on bombing, so I'm sure she'll come around real quick now. But the thing is, and I don't know why the war party's not bringing this up. I'm sorry, I don't mean to give them ideas, but war party doesn't listen to my show anyway. A veteran of ISIS killed two Jews at a museum in Brussels 3 or 4 weeks ago. That was the first blowback in Western Europe. And there are hundreds of these guys. In fact, this is a New York Times story. This is part of the war party narrative. It might take a little while for them to catch up. But foreign jihadis fighting in Syria pose risk in West. That's from May the 29th in the New York Times. That you've got hundreds of these guys who have gone to Syria to fight in the Holy War in the last 3 years, the one supported by the United States and Britain and France and Saudi Arabia, and they got Western passports. So, and you can see what one guy with a shotgun can do at a museum. He turned around and ran. If he had decided it was a suicide mission and he was going to kill as many people as he could, he would have gotten away with a lot more than he did. But it doesn't take much imagination to figure out how some ISIS veterans could cause chaos in Europe and in the United States. And, I just think it'd be too easy for them to slip through the cracks when there's hundreds and hundreds of these guys. And Total Information Awareness is busy reading your email instead of theirs, collecting your telephone location data instead of theirs. Entrapping nobodies into bogus plots instead of keeping an eye out for real ones, I predict that there will be successful attacks. And, hopefully not soon. But, just imagine, the war party right now is caught up in this narrative that the biggest enemy in the Middle East is Bashar al-Assad and the secularist Baathist elected dictatorship in Syria, because that's what Israel wants. But that narrative is going to get washed away here pretty soon. It pales in comparison to the truth of the Islamic State being created there. And once the war party gets a hold of a real narrative here, that's not muddled by, oh, we need to back the rebels in Syria to fight ISIS? What? Once that's over, and like Flint Leverett and Hillary Mann Leverett are writing in the National Interest today, once they go ahead and realize that Bashar al-Assad is their natural ally in this thing, and that the enemy is ISIS over there, once the Republican Party picks up that narrative, and once there's one or two more attacks by veterans of ISIS in Western Europe or the United States, then what are they going to do? How are they going to resist? How are we going to stop them from sending in the Marine Corps at that point? And I know that the solution is to go back in time and to have Barack Obama not back the rebellion in Libya and Syria this whole time. But he did. So, and because the war party on the right had him do it. But here we are. And that's what's next. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about Commodity Discs from CommodityDiscs.com. They're 1 ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity Discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code Commodity Disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's CommodityDiscs.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. The Scott Horton Show. And our first guest on the show today is Eric Margulies. Oh, I forgot to tell you, Dan McAdams is going to be here in just a little while. First is Eric Margulies. EricMargulies.com is his website. Spell it like Margolis. That's how I said it wrong for the first 5 years I knew this guy. Eric Margulies at EricMargulies.com. His books are American Raj, Liberation or Domination, and War at the Top of the World. He writes at EricMargulies.com, at Uns.com, and at LouRockwell.com, of course. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Eric?
I'm fine. I'm watching all this boiling news coming out of the Middle East with fascination.
Yeah, it's a hell of a thing, isn't it? You know, not that you predicted it or anything like that. In fact, let's go back to that. 2000, well, for people who aren't familiar, Eric Margulies, he's a war reporter going way, way back. He knows all about this stuff and has for generations, really. And so back in 2003, a lot of people like to claim, oh, gee, well, nobody knew better or something like that. Eric Margulies certainly did know better. You wrote about it in the newspaper, wherever they would actually let you write in the newspaper. You wrote about it, talked about it on the radio, wrote about it in the American Conservative Magazine and antiwar.com and other places, trying to warn against the invasion of Iraq. And so, without padding your resume now with hindsight and all of that, tell us honestly, and I know you can, and it's good enough, what exactly were you warning against? What would be so wrong with attacking Iraq? After all, Saddam Hussein, bad guy, that kind of thing.
Well, I'd covered Iraq before 2003, and actually from the mid-70s. I knew that Saddam Hussein had been a close ally of the U.S., particularly in the war against Iran, and he had, I believe, either grown too big for his britches or been lured into attacking Kuwait to be brought down a couple of pegs by the first Bush administration. In any event, what I foresaw was that, nasty as Saddam was, that whatever his overthrow would lead to worse, that Iraq would disintegrate into at least three parts. It would cause great instability in the Middle East. It would create major headaches for the United States, and that I insisted that Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction, no links to the 9/11 attacks or other terrorist groups, and that, as I wrote in the American Conservative, it was an article called A March to Folly. Attacking Iraq would be one of the great political miscalculations in modern American history, and so it was.
Yeah. All right, now, it occurred to me way back then, and it still occurs to me now, that even, just for argument's sake, if you take for granted the invasion and the regime change, that, boy, they could have done it better. In fact, I interviewed a guy just a few months ago who talked about how America really, they didn't just let Saddam put down the Shiite Kurdish uprising in 1991. They actually helped. They landed American helicopters on the highway and prevented an army division that was marching on Baghdad from getting there and that kind of thing. And his argument, I'm sorry, I forget the guy's name, but his argument was if America just let things take their course then, they probably, you know, Saddam Hussein would have been overthrown, but then there would have come to a much more amicable type of agreement. And it occurs to me the same thing is true, you know, immorally speaking, but just, you know, facts on the ground wise, counterfactual sort of thing. If they had overthrown Saddam Hussein and then cut and ran and just left, then it seems like there would have been much more incentive for all sides to try to work something out. And maybe not. Maybe there would have been a civil war anyway. But as long as they had the U.S. Army and the U.S. Marine Corps to help the Badr Brigade kick all the Sunni Arabs out of Baghdad, then, hey, why not? Why settle for compromise when you can take everything from Baghdad to Basra and then screw Fallujah and Mosul? Who even cares about that? They got, and this was the Iranian thing all along, what the Supreme Islamic Council wanted all along, what they called strong federalism, which is just, hey, America, give us the capital city and then get the hell out. And so it seems like, or I don't know, what do you think? If the Americans had just got rid of Saddam and left, do you think it would have been a massive civil war like this? Or maybe they could have held the Iraqi state together and worked things out?
No, I think there would probably have been a civil war. You know, what went down in Iraq is very similar to what is going to happen in Kabul, Afghanistan soon. A puppet army is going to run. We, the Americans, have the old divide and conquer. We have allied ourselves with minorities in Afghanistan, the Tajiks and the Uzbeks, against the majority Pashtuns. Well, in Iraq, it's a little bit different because we've allied ourselves with the majority Shiites against the minority Sunnis. But you have the same puppet army in the same situation. Scott, you know, what really kept haunting American policymakers was the fact that Saddam was the genie, it was the plug, the cork that kept the Iranian genie in its bottle. And they were afraid that if Saddam were overthrown, that the Iranians would just run riot over Iraq, which has already begun happening.
Right. Yeah, that was from the WikiLeaks, the heroic Chelsea Manning WikiLeaks there, is the king of Saudi Arabia saying to the American ambassador, hey, it was always you, me, and Saddam containing Iran, and now you're going to give them Iraq on a golden platter, not even a silver one, a golden platter. And that is what's happened, only we didn't give them the whole country, we just gave them Baghdad and all the land of Basra. They still don't have the wherewithal to take the predominantly Sunni areas of the country, does it look like. That's why the Iraqi army all turned and fled. Was, I don't even think they imagined that they could hold on to the Sunni areas even as long as they had, right?
That's right. They've had a collapse of morale, but they're now being stiffened, I think, by Iranian volunteers who are coming in. The U.S. will shortly launch drone and heavy air strikes as soon as they can figure out who to bomb and attack. It won't be that easy for the Sunni forces, who are, I believe, backed by Saudi Arabia secretly, or at least funded by Saudi Arabia. You know, I've seen the Saudis and the Iranians in a proxy war. It first began in Afghanistan and has now spread west. Ever since 1980, this is going on behind the scenes.
Well, and this is really the horrible treachery of the Iraq War, that George Bush's best friends, the Saudis, were financing the Sunni-based insurgency and the al-Qaeda insurgency against the American/Iranian occupation and installation of the Shiite parties in power in Baghdad that whole time.
That's right. Well, everybody there in this incredible mess is playing their own game. My last column I just wrote up this weekend at my website is with the enemy of my enemy is no longer my friend. It used to be that way, but now so there's so many players at contra positions going on here that it's very hard to follow. One thing I do emphasize, though, you know, Dick Cheney, back in 2003 or 2004, when asked what was the purpose of the war for Iraq, said it was for Israel and oil. And that terse statement tells us an awful lot. The objective of Cheney and the neocons was not to build a democratic or a Shia-led Iraq or anything else like that. Their objective was to destroy Iraq as a modern functioning state because it posed a military challenge to Israel. It had the capability it would have to make nuclear weapons eventually. It was the most advanced Arab state technologically. So it was decided to destroy Iraq and remove this threat to Israel, and then to grab Iraq's oil, too.
Yeah. Well, as David Wormser put it, in coping with crumbling states, we want to expedite the chaotic collapse. He was talking about Syria, but it's the same faster, please, boiling cauldron type of a theory of the neocons. I'm sorry we got to take this break. We'll be right back with Eric Margulies in just a sec.
Hey, all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Eric Margolies, author of American Raj, writer at LouRockwell.com, Owns.com, EricMargolies.com. And now, so here's the thing, boy, and I don't know if we got enough time to talk about all this stuff, but now that we're talking about the history of the Iraq War and what's behind it all and that kind of thing, it does kind of seem like the neocons and you know, the right-wing nationalists, for that matter, Dick Cheney and them, were basically fooled by Chalabi, the Iranian spy, who, there's a great article in Salon.com by, I forget the guy's name, called How Chalabi Conned the Neocons. Oh, this is going to be great for Israel, he said. Yeah, we're going to get you a Hashemite king like in Jordan, and we're going to build you an oil and a water pipeline to Haifa, and hey, Richard Pearl, yeah, whatever you imagine, that's what's going to come true. It's going to be great, you stupid idiot. But meanwhile, he was working for the Ayatollah. Hey, INC headquarters was in Tehran, and the plan all along was to empower the Shia, to empower the Iranians. And so maybe Iraq isn't the most powerful Arab state anymore, but now Iran is twice as powerful as it ever was before. So I don't think that's what Ariel Sharon's rotting corpse was actually going for in the first place, but in the beginning of 2004, the Ayatollah Sistani said, "Let my people vote." And then that was it. No more caucus system. No more sock puppet dictatorship. Next mustache in line. Didn't matter whether they had debothified and abolished the army or not. Once Sistani said, "We're the majority and you said democracy, so let's see it," what were they going to do? Start the war all over again against the South? So I just wonder, I mean, I know they're up to no good. I just wonder if this is the no good they were really up to.
The U.S. Derived a lot of its information about Iraq from Israeli intelligence. It couldn't admit it, but the U.S. was misled into the war, but misled because it wanted to believe, according to orders from on top, from the Bush White House and from the Pentagon and from Cheney, who sandbagged the CIA into producing erroneous information. These were all people, you know, feed us the information we want to justify a war. And you've mentioned many times how this was planned out in neocon circles, and then they was egged on by the Israelis, saw tremendous benefit. And in fact, Israel is the only country to really benefit from the 2003 war.
Well, what about Iran? It seems like they did way well, and Osama bin Laden's guys. But
well, you're right. Yes, Iran, right, got some minor benefit from it. They got rid of Saddam Hussein, who was a primary enemy, and they've got their men in power now in Baghdad. But they have not moved into Iraq as everyone feared at the time.
Right. Well, they haven't really needed to. I mean, they got the Dawa Party and the Supreme Islamic Council guys in there. But
yeah, the UK Guardian newspaper is reporting today that 2,000 Iranian troops, Basiji, who are their sort of militia, have moved into Iraq already.
Yeah, the Wall Street Journal was saying that, I guess, last Friday, but it seemed, I don't know if that was really right or not. The way they said it was they had already taken back part of Tikrit, and that didn't sound right.
No,
that far,
it's not.
That deep into now enemy territory there. All right, so anyway, we got to fast forward to the Obama years here because it seems like, if the Iranians got all land from Baghdad to Basra, Bush turned all of the West and northwestern Iraq into lawless Wild West jihadistan, at least for quite a time there until the so-called awakening and the tribal councils kind of putting down their rebellion. But then Obama came into power and supported these guys outright, where Bush's folly was the best thing that ever happened to them. Obama doubled it by taking their side in Libya and in Syria. And so, and you're one of the first people who was reporting back in 2011, Eric, that you had sources saying the Saudis are bankrolling this, that the French are in on it, that they've got spies and special forces in Syria. And this is, you know, back to the 1980s again, only now 3,000 miles to the west of Reagan's adventure in Afghanistan.
That's right. We've entered into a new era of neocolonialism, with the European powers and the U.S. now moving very rapidly into the Middle East and into Africa, not to mention parts of Asia, too. So, I mean, American troops are all over Central Africa now, in a race against the Chinese and the French. This all has echoes of the 19th century. The French are very, very involved in the mess in Syria. And look, all these jihadi groups that sprang up and have been financed by the West and armed by the West and the Saudis, and the Gulf sheikhdoms, we're seeing blowback from this jihadi uprising into Iraq. So the situation is terribly confusing.
Well, and now I guess the way I've understood it is that, and information has been pretty limited out of there, but it sort of seems like the scam is, oh yeah, we're backing the moderates, but they're giving way more money and way more weapons than there is demand by any moderate faction. And of course, their definition of moderate are the Al-Farouk Brigade cannibals, because hey, at least they're for elections, and the Northern Storm Brigade Iraq War veterans, because hey, at least they get along well with John McCain. And these are supposedly the moderates. But then the U.S., the CIA, the Saudis, the Qataris, they send them all the money and weapons, but all that stuff ends up in the hands almost immediately of the al-Nusra Front and the ISIS guys, because they're the ones who are the dedicated fighters in Syria. In fact, in comparison to the Iraq War, it seems like in the Iraq War, the al-Qaeda were the fringe of the insurgency, maybe still are, whereas in Syria, this is really their war, and it's not very plausible deniability. That's what I keep calling it. Oh, yeah, well, the Saudis are backing the moderates, and we're standing back watching. In other words, Barack Obama is working with the Saudis to arm the ISIS suicide bombers by way of, you know, what, 1 week's delay? They give a tow missile to a moderate in the Islamic Front, who then gives it to al-Nusra in a couple of days later. What the hell is that?
Well, it's a joke, and it's a bad one. And here we're told that the Saudis are funneling aid to the, quote, moderate, unquote. These are the moderate Saudis who cut off people's heads and hands and won't let women drive and deny any civil rights to anybody, one of the most repressive regimes on earth. They're dealing with moderates? I don't think so. The Saudis have a long history that goes back to 1980 or even earlier of financing all kinds of wild men and extremist groups as long as they stay out of Saudi Arabia. And that's been their policy, and it's worked well for them.
Yeah. Well, now, how much control can the Americans or the Saudis or anyone else pretend to have over these guys that they're letting loose here?
Oh, very little. Our intelligence agencies have been awful at figuring out who's who. Did a better job in Afghanistan, but here, and it is very difficult. It's hard to figure out which group is which, and they're changing, and they keep changing names, and new groups keep jumping up. We really don't know. We're at the mercy of Saudi intelligence for a lot of it. I don't think we can really make a coherent policy. I'm going to make another point, too, Scott, that all the fighting that's going on in Iraq right now is not being done by the ISIS jihadis. What we're seeing is an uprising by Saddam Hussein's old Ba'ath Party, which the U.S. disbanded, you remember, under Bush's orders. But these groups now, they're veterans of the Iraqi army and the war against Iran. They are at the forefront of the fighting now against the Shia forces,
right,
and they are pretty capable. So it's all, they're also nationalists as well as jihadis.
And now, I think that must be right. And I was just reading an article to the People earlier, these Iraqi Sunni scholars saying, no, this is the same old Sunni-based insurgency. Al-Qaeda is just the fringe. And I guess they're the ones out front doing most of the dying and the fighting and whatever. But that really, like you're saying, this is just the Sunni, you know, I guess, religious leaders, Baathists, and tribal leaders and whatever. And now, but I wonder how you compare that to Syria. Am I right that where the jihadists are really a small percentage of the insurgency in Iraq, they're really a much greater percentage of it's really their war in Syria, and the rest of the Sunnis seem to be sitting it out or siding with Assad, no?
Yeah, the professional centrists, if you want to call it, in Syria are siding with the Assad government. So they're non-professionals who are fighting, as opposed to Iraq, where you have a lot of the old guard, which has now risen up. But the West won't admit it. We keep calling them terrorists.
Mm-hmm. Hey, is there any chance you feel like doing one more segment with me after the break here?
For you, yes.
Thank you so much, Eric. And we'll be back at 6 after. So go ahead and take a break, and we'll be right back, everybody, with Eric Margolies. Really appreciate it. But we got so much more to talk about here. And then Dan McAdams coming up, too, y'all. ScottHorton.org. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
All right. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Coming up, Dan McAdams on Ukraine. Right now, we're talking with Eric Margolies, also at the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. I don't usually remember to mention that in your bio there at the top of these segments, Eric, but glad I just
thought. Thank you, Scott. Thank you. I'm proud to be there.
Yeah, well, it should be. What a great organization to be a part of. All right, so we're talking about, you know, the U.S. on all sides of all conflicts over there in the Middle East, as always. And but now I wonder what you think is going to happen next. Is this, well, let's go back to one thing that you said earlier, was that this is not really ISIS taking over Western and Northwestern Iraq. This is the Sunni leaders, the former Baathists. The other Sunni leaders, the same old Sunni insurgency. I wonder if this is their final declaration of independence, since the Iraqi army of the Shiite parties clearly have no ability to put down their insurrection, even with Iranian help. How are they going to retake Mosul? They can't. It's not their city.
Well, they're hoping for American help. Certainly, I think that we'll see U.S. drones very actively operating there within hours, if not days. We'll see significant American airstrikes, and we'll see the U.S. giving a green light to Iran to send more troops in there to buttress up the Shia forces, which will just consolidate the ethnic religious division of Iraq into three parts, Kurds in the north, Shias in the east, and Sunnis in the west.
Yeah, well, it seems like it's already pretty much a done deal. I mean, when the ISIS guys say they're going to march on Najaf, that sounds just as ridiculous as the Badr Brigade being able to take back Mosul. I mean, at this point, the lines are drawn, and I'm surprised it lasted this long before the final break. But then again, you know, like we're talking about, the relative power of this group, ISIS, to declare this Islamic State, they seem to be going pretty far in establishing a state in Syria. But like you're saying, again, the Baathists and others are still in the driver's seat in Iraq. So I wonder how you think that's going to play out. After all, you know, the Sykes-Picot line may be fake, but it's also 100 years old. So there are still some differences, right, between the Syrian and the Iraqis and their goals here?
Well, yes, of course. Sykes-Picot poor listeners who don't remember this point, was a secret agreement drawn up in 1916 by the British and French, who had promised the Arabs freedom and independent states after World War One, and actually was a secret agreement to divide up the whole area between the British and French, which resulted in today's artificial borders in the Middle East. The there are those in the jihadist groups who are not all Islamic wild men or crazies, who want to erase, start reversing Sykes-Picot and take the Arab world back to its more unified state that it was under the Ottoman Empire.
All right, but so now when it comes to the American intervention there, that I agree with you, it has to just be inevitable here, because what are they going to do? Not intervene if there's a place to intervene. But then again, you know, if occupying Iraq only created more and more of these, you know, would-be enemies, at least these wild men, as you call them, and if the drone wars, even in Pakistan and Yemen, in Somalia, only make more and more of these guys, what's going to happen when you have fleets of American drones and maybe F-16s too flying air cover for Iranian troops on the ground? And I mean, it seems like no matter what we're doing, if George Bush is trying to fight and oppose these guys, he makes more of them. Barack Obama helps them out and makes even more than that. And so now we're going to revert back to bombing them again, at least on the Iraqi side of the former line here. How much is that going to benefit ISIS and al-Nusra and their allies?
Oh, it will definitely help them, because just as we've seen in Afghanistan, for every bomb that that we Americans drop on them, or attack missile, Hellfire missile, it would generate 10 members, people to go and fight us. So it's very counterproductive, and it's considered cowardly in that part of the world to fight from the air and not mano a mano on the ground.
Yeah. Well, now, I mean, it would be problematic to try to, you know, find some kind of consistency here other than just, you know, Michael Ledeen's boiling cauldron. Although that sort of seems like too easy of an answer. But there's no consistency at all in this policy, though it would make sense, would it not, for America to go ahead and say, like John Kerry's saying today, well, yeah, we're going to talk with the Iranians about working together on this thing. We're open to talking with them. At least it would make sense to work with Iran, with the Shiite-based Baathists in Syria, against the al-Qaeda guys, since they're actually the Americans' enemies and Iran's really not. Iran's only real offense attack against America was declaring independence from us back in 79. I mean, I guess Beirut 83, but that ain't much in 2014.
Well, Scott, according to the great United States Congress, Iran is a terrorist state, and there's a law on the books that we can't talk to terrorist states. I don't know if it's going to be observed, but we've been so busy painting people with this stupid branding of terrorism that now we've precluded intelligent discussion with them. So there's going to be a lot of resistance in Congress to doing anything with Iran, because Israel's not going to like it. The jihadists in the West we can't even talk to moderate elements there because we can't find them. It's a crazy situation. Our logical ally in this whole mess is President Bashar Assad in Damascus.
Well, you know, it's funny. It seems like at this point, actually, treachery on the part of the American Congress and the American War Party on behalf of Israel is helping to confuse the narrative in picking Assad as the bad guys and the rebels as the good guys in Syria. At least it's precluding a more simple narrative that, look, al-Qaeda state, let's attack it, which would be a much simpler and more accurate actual, you know, representation of the situation. But because they put Israel first, and they're still so hell-bent on Iran and Assad, they can't get their narrative simple and straight that here is a new war we have to have.
Well, Scott, this is a tough marketing job, peddling a new war in this area to the American public. And al-Qaeda state is the obvious choice for people who really don't understand the situation. Well, in fact, al-Qaeda is a teeny player in this whole situation, even with the jihadis in Syria. Al-Qaeda is down to a handful of members. It's a boogeyman, but it's used to scare Westerners into doing something.
Well, do you know some good relative numbers of members of ISIS and members of the al-Nusra Front in Syria?
I'm not sure about the Nusra Front, but I've seen estimates of ISIS of around 8,000 people. In Syria. They're not going to win any major wars. Right. They can create a lot of nuisance value. And as far as the ISIS in Iraq goes, I would say probably around 5,000 to 6,000 fighters.
Well, you know, this, for some reason, hasn't gotten that much attention. Again, I think it's because of this Israel first, Assad is the bad guy, not the suicide bomber, you know, victim crucifiers in Syria, that they haven't taken off and run with the fact that a veteran, a French veteran of ISIS, killed two Jews at a museum in Brussels a few weeks ago. That, to me, is why I'm so convinced that this is going to blow up into a major war, that that Israel first, Assad is the bad guy narrative is going to end up falling to the side here, because you've got hundreds and hundreds of Western Europeans who have gone to fight in Syria, and who have Western passports, and some of whom, at least, are going to be able to make it back into Western Europe without being stopped by whatever international police or intelligence agencies, and probably some of them are going to come here. And then, how are they going to, even if Obama doesn't want to, it's going to mean at least carpet bombing, if not Marines, right?
Scott, we have created the mother of all messes.
It sure sounds like it. Yep, that's the name of the piece here at ericmargulies.com, The Almighty Mess in Iraq. Thank you, Eric. Appreciate it.
Cheers, Scott.
Hey, all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. Coming up, Dan McAdams is going to be on to tell us about what we've been not paying attention to in Ukraine, as all eyes are on Iraq and Syria. And, you know, I don't want anybody to misunderstand me like I'm spinning for Israel here. I'm only joking about the irony that the simple narrative that let's go bomb Jihadistan is confused by the fact that, as Michael Oren puts it, he and Israel, that's the outgoing, well, no longer, but the former Israeli ambassador to America, he prefers these bad guys to those bad guys, meaning he, and therefore the American War Party, prefer the Al-Qaeda prisoner crucifiers, prisoner beheaders, suicide bombers of women and children to those bad guys, meaning the Shiite Baathist party, which is not entirely Shiite, but anyway, the Shiite-backed Baathist party and their allies in Hezbollah. Why? Because, as Michael Oren explained, they're backed by Iran. And Iran is what Israel's so concerned about. It's as simple as that. That was last October, something like that, when Michael Oren said that. But it turns out, ironically, that for now, the Israeli narrative that Bashar al-Assad is the worst bad guy in the region is still holding sway. Obama on the White House lawn the other day, as I ranted and raved uncontrollably, even still said, you know, because of the danger of ISIS, that's why we have to ramp up our support for rebels in Syria. Huh? I think even Chuck Todd is going to start seeing through this here pretty soon. Chuck Todd being my favorite example of complete airhead bimbo, know-nothing idiot TV anchor. Government statement repeater. Huh, this is kind of confusing. Are you sure that the guy with the secular party that was just reelected in a landslide who represents the Christians and the Shiites and the Alawites and the Kurds against the suicide bombers and the people who are crucifying their enemies, literally crucifying their enemies to death in the town square, the same guys who we all agree are the bad guys in Iraq. We got to... Oh, the moderate rebels, the moderate rebels. What moderate rebels? You know, Mitchell Prothero was on the show the other day. He's a reporter. He's not ideological, anti-everything, libertarian like me. He's just a straight news reporter. He's over there, has a lot more information than I got. He knows. Jonathan Lande, his colleague, said, hey, I saw these moderates. They exist in northern Jordan. I saw them training. You know? Okay, cool. So I say, come on, these moderates hardly exist at all. And they say, enough of your hyperbole, Horton. They do too exist. It's just that there's very, very few of them. And yes, the extremists end up getting all the weapons and all the money. And yeah, they're mostly big fat exiles on the payroll who have a lot more interest in hanging out at the hotel than doing any real fighting. And what moderates? Again, yeah. What moderates? The people doing the fighting all along there have been the committed, those least afraid to die, and that is Al-Qaeda, the Al-Nusra Front, and ISIS. And as Patrick Coburn has said on the show, even the so-called moderates, they're basically of the exact same ideology. They want the exact same things here. There's nobody among the Sunni rebellion in Syria who wants real elections and a secular moderate society and a separation of church and state in a country where 30% are religious minorities. And, yeah, anyway. So isn't it funny, back to my point, isn't it funny that, I'm sorry, I go off on a tangent too far sometimes. Isn't it funny that even though ISIS and al-Nusra are the biggest force among the rebels, and that all they have to fight about is who calls the shots, not their ideology, not their goals, not even their tactics or anything else, but just, you know, which mob boss ought to be the one ruling them, that the narrative still is that those are the good guys against the evil of the Ba'athist dictatorship of Bashar al-Assad. If that wasn't true, if the Republican and the Democratic parties in Washington, D.C. weren't filled to the gills with Israel's fifth column in America, then we would already be at a full-scale war right now. At least at a full-scale air war, which I think probably is coming anyway. But we would be at war with Jihadistan. You know, if you look at any of the coverage online or in the newspapers about what's going on here with ISIS, and again, I think Margulies is right that it's overplayed just how much they are in charge in Iraq. But still, you look at the territory they control, most of the maps, they include Syria. But, for example, ABC, and I know there are others like this too, but ABC is the one that I know from the top of my head for sure. They keep showing this map of the land that ISIS rules in Iraq, but somehow it magically stops at the Syrian border. They don't show you that, yeah, this is the same group of the so-called rebels that the U.S. is backing on just the other side of the border that no longer exists there. Guilty conscience much, guys, with your fake-ass Photoshop? Like, we don't all know that some editor said to the cartoonist there, the Photoshop graphics guy, wait. Let's pretend that the Syrian border still exists here. Let's not go making it too obvious what's going on here. And anyway, that's probably the only thing that's keeping us from the next step of worse escalation right now. Not that it's really going to last. I'm just trying to make an ironical, sort of a hilarious point about the treachery of the Israel firsters in Washington, D.C. and their priorities. Oh, what does the former Israeli ambassador to America say our priorities should be, fellow congressman? Oh, we hate Hezbollah more than Al-Qaeda this week, huh? Okay. Man, really, guys? Yep, really. And not just this week, either, for the last 3 years. It's crazy, I tells you. And it's not going to last. It's not going to last. That Israeli narrative is not going to hold, and there's going to be a further war. It's just too simple and too easy of a talking point, you know, to call all of Western Iraq in uprising terrorist land. And I think Obama doesn't want to go back, but I think ultimately he's not going to have a choice, especially because if those ISIS guys are smart, which I assume that they are, they will want to bait the United States into reinvading. That's how terrorism works, see? Provoking a reaction. And of course, there are plenty of interests in America who are looking for some terrorism to overreact about. No doubt about that. There's a massive confluence of interests coming our way. And like I was saying in my paranoid rant to Margulies at the end of the interview there, it's just a matter of time before they come and start blowing up some stuff in Western Europe and provide that pretext for war. Even if they can't get to the U.S., if they start attacking targets in France and in the Netherlands and in Spain and in Britain, then at least there go the drones. And, you know, the F-35 could use a stunt right now since their entire U.K. fleet is grounded because, oh, you know, the engine is broken. But other than that, they could maybe use some bombing runs for some PR there. I don't know. Dan McAdams in a sec, y'all.
Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code SCOTT when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. That should be louder. Louder! All right, well, anyway. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm on the Liberty Radio Network. And at scotthorton.org. Find all my stuff there. All right. Next up is Dan McAdams. He's the director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. Formerly was Ron Paul's chief foreign policy advisor for years in his congressional office there, to his great credit. It's Daniel McAdams. Welcome back to the show. Dan, how are you doing?
Thanks, Scott. I'm doing great. Great to be with you.
Great, great. Very happy to have you here. And you know, it seems like everybody's attention is on Syria and Iraq, which is good and important. However, I bet things in Ukraine did not stop happening just because I wasn't reading about it, but I bet that you have been staying current and keeping up to date on the results of America's coup in Ukraine back in February and the new coup and then sort of pseudo-elected government's efforts to clamp down and extend their monopoly state power in eastern Ukraine. So I guess go ahead and give us the bad news, and I'll try to come up with some follow-up questions as you talk.
You know, it's true. You know, everyone is obsessed with what's going on in Iraq. I have to confess, too, because I just love the possibility of the neocons getting a black eye. But as you know, they're so slippery and slithery that they're still coming out on top. You still see every one of the talk shows featuring the same guys that messed the thing up. You have Tony Blair saying, hey, it wasn't my fault. Don't blame me. You know, so
the virtues of shamelessness. I mean, there's really something to that. I had to try it.
Talk about a guy who took it to the bank, too. You know, I mean, it's disgusting. But as you say, as our attention is focused on Iraq and some really unprecedented things that are happening there, you know, things go on as they had in Ukraine and probably even amped up a little bit because attention is elsewhere. I've been watching some YouTube videos today of some pretty serious Kiev shelling in Slavyansk in residential areas. You can see, you know, a lot of apartment blocks, and then you see the big smoke. You know, these days everyone has got a camera, everyone's got a cell phone that takes video, so there's no end to it. It seems like the only people that aren't interested and aren't paying attention is the State Department. You know, to all these videos, it's pretty easy to find them. Mm-hmm. Apparently, an old Orthodox church was blown up in some of the shelling today. So it has increased. It has continued. If you remember last week, Poroshenko, the new elected president, supposedly elected president, said, oh, he's going to wrap things up by the end of last week and it'll all be done and there'll be peace and ceasefire. And now he's saying, well, maybe by the end of this week he'll be done. And meanwhile, he keeps ratcheting up the violence. You have streams of people leaving the country. And you also have this sort of disturbing trend that no one has really talked too much about, but the push for humanitarian corridors. And it does sound good on the surface. And Poroshenko has said, you know, he's theoretically open to the idea of humanitarian corridors. However, if you remember back to Kosovo, when the back in 98-99, when the Macedonian president, Gligorov, I think his name was, recommended humanitarian corridors for Kosovo, he was attacked by NATO for a sort of backdoor ethnic cleansing. So you can almost imagine if they do get these corridors up and running, you can see kind of a quiet ethnic cleansing mm-hmm. of Russian speakers and ethnic Russians, particularly if you combine that with two very important events that, came to the fore this week. Our old friend Yats, you remember him, Vicky Nuland's friend, mm-hmm. The prime minister of Ukraine, Yatsenyuk, he called the people in the East who are fighting for their autonomy, quote, subhumans, you know, which we remember the Untermenschen, you know, the Nazis used, which was very controversial. And it's a way of, you know, you demonize your enemies before you slaughter them. And also something that came out today, which is quite interesting. It was in the Kiev Post, which is no friend of Russia, as you know. But apparently the Ukraine's land agency has offered to give free land to any soldiers from the West who go to the East and start fighting. So I hate to bring this too far, but this is sort of a Lebensraum kind of idea that, you know, you'll get free land in the East if you help us kick all the people out of the East. So it is, I know that was a mouthful, Scott, but that's in a nutshell, I guess.
God dang. Can you imagine if this was happening? Well, it's hard to imagine anywhere in the world where one side or another isn't America's proclaimed business or something like that, but... Anyway, if you could imagine a situation where there's any kind of dispute like this and it's not America's fight, what they would have to say about it, or maybe, you know, they're on the side of the people who are losing. I mean, I guess all we have to do is rewind to last fall what they had to say about the government daring to hold on, the elected government in Kiev daring to hold on to power against a violent Nazi-backed putsch against them. But
yeah, and how they were screaming that, you know, we saw the cops that were out there trying to put an end to this protest in the Maidan. They didn't even have weapons, yet the U.S. was still screaming at them, don't do anything, you better not use violence against these peaceful protesters. And meanwhile, you and I are watching videos of these cops being burned alive, and, you know, we don't have any great affection for cops, but, you know, you do have to be kind of ticked off at a government who sends cops out in a situation like this while they're sitting in their offices, and these guys are getting burned alive, and they don't have any kind of protection at all. So it's there's a lot to be infuriated about with the previous government, but certainly when you talk about double standards, here these you know, this current regime is shelling people, shelling communities. The U.S. is saying absolutely nothing.
Yeah, it's crazy. And look, I mean, I don't know who all was there in the Maidan. I'm sure it was everybody and their grandmothers too, and with a lot of peaceful motives and whatever. But the push
sure.
was done by the Americans and the Germans, who threatened to put sanctions on every last billionaire in the Party of Regions if they didn't forsake their guy. So they forsook him. And on the ground, by real, legit, no fooling, Hitler-loving Nazis from the Svoboda and Right Sector parties that even the New York Times narrated. There they go, seizing all the government buildings and chasing the government out of town. So, you know...
Yeah.
It's pretty hard to see that as like a fight between liberty and the state. It's much more like, yeah, a bunch of Nazis seized the state. I'm really impressed, you know?
What's really amazing is this. I don't hate to say this. I love to say this. What am I saying? The absolute spinelessness of Europe and the European Union, you know. You had Sikorsky, the Polish foreign minister, the German foreign minister, I believe, and one or two other people who crafted this deal on the night of, what was it, February 21st or something like this, where you would have sort of a power-sharing deal. You'd have a climb down, a back down. It was a compromise, early elections. The Yanukovych government agreed to all of it. Basically, they went to bed and everything was sealed. And the next morning, that's when the coup took place. You know, so, you know, it seems to me as if the U.S. knew all along this is what it was launching. And I think Victoria Nuland told us in no uncertain terms that's what she had in mind for the EU. But, I mean, wouldn't you, if you had spent all that time negotiating this deal, only to have the U.S. just bulldoze over you without even, you know, giving you the finger on the way by, I mean, wouldn't you be a little bit irritated? But they're so, especially people like Sikorsky, is so eager to suck up to the U.S. neocons that they even show any of their sort of pride aside.
Now, Dan, when Yats, as Victoria Nuland calls him, Yatsenyuk, the new prime minister here in the Putsch government, when he says that, oh, yeah, we're fighting against these subhumans, meaning the Russian speakers or the ethnic Russians in eastern Ukraine, was that, can you tell me the context of that? Was it kind of an open mic moment? Was it a set up open mic moment, a deliberate provocation by him? Did he go up and give a speech and denounce them for their lack of humanity? Because, you know, there was the leaked phone call of Timoshenko, mm-hmm. the gas princess, basically saying, yeah, let's nuke them all. Not that she meant it literally, but how much she hated everyone in the East. Basically, it sounded like relinquishing any pretense of her right to rule over them, which seemed like really a dumb mistake on her part. But then again, if they were trying to make things worse and precipitate more of a civil war, more of a humanitarian crisis and an ethnic cleansing situation, like you're saying, then I guess it would make sense for her and Yatsenyuk to go ahead and say, you know, the people of the East are the enemy rather than, you know, people we need to compromise with in our democracy. And now you can see that I've asked this question all the way up into the break. I'm sorry, Dan, the music's playing. The music's playing and we got to go to break.
Give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror.
That was me, not you. I thought it was me interrupting me. I thought it was you interrupting me. It was me interrupting me.
Iran, central banking,
we'll be back in a goddamn minute.
And, well, you know, every...
Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. CNI stands against America's negative role in the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the war party's relentless push to bomb Iran, and the roles played by twisted Christian Zionism and neocon-engineered Islamophobia in justifying it all. But they can't do it without you. Support CNI's push to straighten out America's crooked course. Check out the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and click Donate under About Us at the top of the page.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, this is my show. And man, I suck at broadcasting, I'm sorry, I don't got any hard breaks and bumper music and... Never mind. Anyway, so when we were going out to break, I was trying to ask Dan McAdams of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity about whether he thinks that Yatsenyuk, America's sock puppet prime minister of Ukraine, what was the context of him denouncing the pro-Russian East as being made up of subhumans, and whether he thought maybe that was a deliberate provocation in order to help divide the population, help precipitate the civil war and that ethnic cleansing that seems to be, you know, at the root of part of the strategy here.
Yeah, well, the statement itself appeared on the Ukrainian embassy in the U.S., so it was an official source, and it's kind of interesting. Someone must have tipped them off because they've changed the word now just today. This went up there yesterday. They changed it today to inhuman rather than subhuman, but it certainly was originally subhuman, and people have screenshots. What he says is the people have been killed by invaders and sponsored by subhumans. First, we'll commemorate the heroes by wiping out those who killed them, and then by cleaning our land from the evil. Which sounds pretty spooky.
Yeah. Well, so now, so what is the state of the rebellion? How many different countries have their local government buildings occupied by secessionists or those who are resisting the so-called authority of the Kiev government?
Well, supposedly Mariupol was taken back by the Kiev authorities, and you know, I don't know the exact situation on the ground right now as to who's controlling who. I know that there have been some pretty serious attacks on Russian embassies and consulates, including, I think right now there's a standoff outside the Russian consulate in Odessa, which is in recent memory a place of real conflict. Mm-hmm. But, you know, yesterday there was a huge riot outside the Russian embassy in Kiev where the flag was taken down and the Ukrainian flag was raised. They threw all kinds of paint bombs and things at the embassy, smoke bombs inside the embassy. And now, I mean, this is just, you know, what the government in Kiev always does. It says actually it was the Russians who did it to themselves. It was just a provocation that Russians were the ones out there attacking their own embassy, overturning their own cars, and just to make us look bad. So it's, and if you remember, that's exactly what they said about Odessa when all those people were burned to death. They said, oh, they did it to themselves. And when the missile went through the administration building in Lugansk, they said, oh, these guys shot themselves. So they always say the same things when these things happen. Hardly believable.
So when it comes to the military attack, I mean, it does seem, as horrible as the consequences of it have been for the people on the ground there, it seems like a pretty ineffectual assault, right? I mean, are they any closer than they ever have been to, you know, really having, you know, getting some kind of surrender out of the secessionists at large and an end to the resistance to their authority here, a real extension of their monopoly power? Because it sure doesn't seem like it. Slaughter a few people here, an air attack there.
Well, you made a great point, Scott. If what they're trying to do is drive these people further away, then they're doing a heck of a good job of it. If they're actually trying to keep the country together, this is the, shooting mortars into apartment buildings is not the way to have people develop an affectionate attitude toward the Kiev government. Right. So,
attitude aside, it's possible to win a military victory by crushing your opponents, too, and forcing a surrender. Not that I'm saying that would be the right thing to do.
Yeah,
you're
right.
But I'm just saying it doesn't seem like they're trying to do that either. They're just bombing people kind of at random, like Orwell, rocket bomb lands in the neighborhood every once in a while.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that the problem that the U.S. government and the great foreign policy experts here in the West refuse to admit, and it's just simply basically true, they don't have the hearts and minds on the ground. It's not just a few Russian-backed people who are coming out there and terrorizing everyone. We saw the millions of people who are lined up to vote to secede. And it's the same thing that we saw in Syria. Regardless of how we feel about Assad, he's genuinely popular. Every opinion poll, every vote, there are millions of people that voted for him. There are millions of people in eastern Ukraine who want nothing to do with Kiev. And so it's difficult to win a military victory when you simply don't have the support of the people. And maybe that's why you have to look toward ethnic cleansing to get rid of these people. And who knows, maybe that's what they're doing.
Yeah, well, I mean, when you talk about the humanitarian crisis, it doesn't take much to keep one going and to keep ratcheting it up. And then, as you said, a humanitarian corridor is the kind of thing that, you know, the Americans might be right if they weren't, if it wasn't their guy's plan. They might be right to criticize that as sort of a backdoor way of, you know, in the short term, it makes perfect sense for civilian refugees to flee a war zone or whatever. But how are they ever going to come back again? And aren't they ultimately just, you know, ceding that territory then? Kind of a thing. I could see that. It's sort of like they used to talk about building a subway between the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And I always thought, well, that would be great if you assume any kind of independence and sovereignty for Palestine. Otherwise, it's just a great way for the Israelis to put all the Palestinians on the West Bank on a railroad car to the Gaza prison. You know?
Yeah, no, that's true. It's true. So it's very tricky, you know. And the other thing you probably saw this past week was this claim that Kiev made that the U.S. government immediately jumped on, that there's a column of Russian tanks.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
Crossing the border into Ukraine. And, of course, they provided no evidence. The videos that we saw showed three pretty crappy T-64s, which is an old model of tank that's not used by the Russians anymore. And the U.S. and the State Department said, well, these are definitely Russian tanks because there are no tanks from the Kiev government operating in the area. Which is a joke. What are they talking about? You know, have they been sleeping through this whole assault on eastern Ukraine? So, you know, once again, they provided no evidence. It was just the headline went out, you know, Drudge and everyone else picked it up. Column of Russian tanks enters Ukraine. Mm-hmm. It sounds ominous. But, and as I wrote a piece last week, hey, that's fine. Maybe they're telling the truth this time. But we've been burned so many times before. They need to provide us some evidence, and they haven't.
Yeah, exactly.
I looked at pictures of these tanks, and they've got Ukrainian flags on them. So, you know, the credibility is shot, especially as we look what's happening with Iraq this week. It just reminds us of how the government lies to us in every way, shape, or form, you know, constantly.
And, you know, I can understand why decent people would want to think that, okay, look, if they told me 10 lies before, the next thing's got to be true, because there's got to be a limit to their dishonesty, right? Like, could people just want to assume and figure out a way that it must be for good somehow? I guess war is good for the economy. They just rationalize it some way, but no, it's all lies. It's ridiculous. Like, oh yeah, they sent in 3 tanks. They're not invading, but they just want to give you an excuse to ratchet up your support for the Nazis. Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
As I said, if this is the big Russian invasion, then there really is no Russian threat, because if all they can muster is 3 crappy tanks, forget it.
Yeah, this is the rise of the new Soviet Union, huh? I'm shaking in my boots. All right. Well, so now let me ask you about, well, okay, first of all, well, a couple things I'll ask you at once. In the chat room, somebody asked, is it true that the Kiev government was caught using chemical weapons in the east? I hadn't heard that. I don't know if you have. But then also, I would ask you to please talk about the right sector and the Svoboda militias, the neo-Nazis, or maybe just plain old Nazis, that helped with the putsch back in February, what they're doing nowadays, because I sure would like to know.
Sure. Well, on the first one, you know, we've seen videos of what looks like white phosphorus.
Oh, and talk real fast. We're almost out of time.
Okay, being fired in Slavyansk area. The Russians have tried to complain to the UN. Of course, the U.S. is blocking it. It looks very serious. The second one, the right sector and these fascist groups or neo-fascist groups have been subsumed into this National Guard because the regular Ukrainian army has proven itself ineffective. It doesn't have the stomach to fight against its own citizens. But the right sector types have no problem doing this. And so they're the ones that are in the National Guard. They're the ones that are moving on the east in the most aggressive way, the stormtroopers.
And yet they're still just, you know, basically street brawler, you know, SA types, not real military forces that can fight in a real military capacity, right?
Well, you're probably right. I don't have any evidence, but I know a special ops guy that I talked to once said that these guys had been trained by the CIA for quite some time and the SAS. Who knows? Maybe the guy was just yanking my chain, but I've seen some pictures of them with trainers that look like British with British flags behind them. So maybe they have been getting some instruction.
Right. Yeah, I wonder about that. You know, there was Stephen Cohen, the husband of Katrina Vandenhuevel from The Nation there. He's been really good on this, of course, all along. And there's actually, I think I'm 90% sure, Dan, it was he who was interviewing a guy in The Nation about 70 years of American support for Ukrainian Nazis ever since the end of the Second World War versus anti-communist forces, but then never stopping. But anyway, now the beat's playing and we got to go. Thank you so much for your time coming back on the show, Dan.
Thanks, Scott. Take care.
That's Daniel McAdams, everybody, director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. Back in a sec. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the goddamn show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And by the way, man, I meant to interrupt Eric Margolese, and I probably did, but then I didn't remember why I wanted to interrupt him. But why I wanted to interrupt him was to provide a footnote for his assertion. 2 footnotes. 3 or 4. Eric Margolese, when I was talking about how Iran helped lie us into war, and the DIA and the CIA say that Ahmed Chalabi was working for them all along and duped the neocons, I think that's right. And Eric said, yeah, and you know who else? Well, he didn't really respond to that, but he said the Israelis manufactured intelligence, and that was a lot of what America was going with. And he got that right. And you know who says so? Julian Borger in The Guardian, the spies who pushed for war. Julian Borger in The Guardian, the spies who pushed for war. They're not the spies. The Lockheed lobbyists, the Ariel Sharon lobbyists in Washington, D.C., that's who they are. They pushed the spies to push lies to justify their war, if that's what you mean. But anyway, that's the damn title of the thing. The spies who pushed for war. And then there is Agents of Influence by Robert Dreyfuss in The Nation. Agents of Influence by Dreyfuss. In fact, if you just search Agents of Influence, you might be surprised, but there it is on the first page. Agents of Influence by Dreyfuss in The Nation. And both of those describe how in Israel, in Ariel Sharon's office, that he actually had the same problem that Dick Cheney had with the CIA. They couldn't get them to lie quite good enough about the Iraqi threat. And so Ariel Sharon created his own little office of special plans in the office of the prime minister, where they manufactured fake intelligence in English to funnel into the American, the so-called stovepipe of intelligence from, you may be young and you don't know about this, but basically Dick Cheney created his own little separate government. That's what Colin Powell even called it, a separate government. Inside the government. It was Dick Cheney and his neocon allies. So he had, of course, David Addington and Scooter Libby in his office. He had Stephen Hadley as Rice's deputy on the National Security Council. He had John Bolton and David Wurmser in the State Department. And even though Bolton is not a neocon, but a lifelong conservative, he still is very close and was part of that same network. And then in the Pentagon, where the neocons really took root, and that was Richard Perle and his ally, Newt Gingrich, who actually is another, I think, lifelong conservative, but still very close to this AEI group. And they ran the Defense Policy Board. And then you had Paul Wolfowitz, who is the Deputy Secretary of Defense. And then in the Office for Policy, you had Douglas Feith, Abram Shulsky, and Michael Rubin, and Michael Ledeen, and all these other guys doing work in the Office of Special Plans, coming up with a bunch of crap, basically, to scare your mom into supporting the war against Iraq. And this was the so-called stovepipe, and it was written about. Feith's little group was called the Office of Special Plans, and then also with a guy named Michael Maloof, he created something that was called the Counterterrorism Policy Evaluation Group, where they made up lies about Saddam and Osama. But the main Office of Special Plans was about the weapons of mass destruction lies. And you can read all about this. Now, the direct tie to Ariel Sharon's guys manufacturing intelligence in English, that's pretty limited. There's Julian Borger. There's, again, the spies who push for war, Robert Dreyfuss, agents of influence. And then there's James Bamford in the book A Pretext for War. And then Karen Kotowski, she doesn't really call it confirmation because she's being very careful, but I think it's, at least sort of confirmation that she tells the story about Israelis coming to visit Douglas Feith at the Pentagon when she was an Air Force lieutenant colonel, and her job was to escort them to Feith's office, but instead they led the way and barged right in and made themselves right at home like they own the place kind of thing, and how she and her other officers, whose job it was to escort them, and in deep into the Pentagon, too, were, pretty astonished at the brazenness of the comfort level or whatever. Now, that doesn't really mean that they were there to deliver lies that day or whatever, but it does help to illustrate the closeness in the relationship. After all, Douglas Feith's law partner, Mark Zell, represents, I believe, lives in the West Bank, on the West Bank, and owns a law firm whose job it is representing occupiers on the West Bank. So-called settlers, colonial settlers on the West Bank. So anyway, in fact, there's even an anecdote of Condoleezza Rice telling Douglas Feith, "Okay, Doug, when we need to know what Ariel Sharon thinks, we'll just call him." We already have exactly what he wants, registered here in our discussion. So thanks very much. Colonel Larry Wilkerson, who was Colin Powell's right-hand man, said on this show that he regarded Douglas Feith, and out of all the neocons I just named, too, he regarded Douglas Feith and David Wurmser as direct agents of influence for Israel. They were not just, neocon-friendly, Israel-friendly neocons who can't tell the difference for the life of them between Israeli interests and American interests. No, they were outright working for the Israeli government, said Lawrence Wilkerson. I don't think he claimed that he could prove that, but that was how he regarded them. And that was, Colin Powell's right-hand man on this show described them that way. So But again, I think that, and yeah, they got what they wanted, which was the destruction of Iraq as the most powerful, you know, would-be enemy Arab state of theirs in the region and that kind of thing. But at the same time, I don't think that they meant for the Ayatollahs and the mullahs in Iran and their friends to end up on top and ruling all of Baghdad and all that. I don't think that was their plan. I think that the Iranians really exploited the Israelis because, hey, after all, the Yanan plan and the clean break and all of this, the clean break was written by David Wurmser, Richard Perle, Douglas Feith. That's their signatures on it there back in 1996, urging regime change against Saddam Hussein. So the Iranians are no dummies. They knew that the neocons are dummies. And if the neocons want to reverse the Reaganite policy of shoring up Saddam Hussein to contain the Iranian revolution, then they will do whatever they can to help the neocons. Which is so funny because the neocons, according to them, more than anyone else, Iran is America's enemy, right? I don't really consider Iran America's enemy, but they certainly do, and yet they're the ones doing Iran's dirty work. They've done more for Iran than anybody, more for the mullahs, the Ayatollahs that rule Iran, than anybody since the revolutionaries of 79 put them in power by overthrowing Saddam. And not just that, but fighting a war on behalf of the Supreme Islamic Council and the Dawah Party and the Badr Brigades, who are the pro-Iranians, the most pro-Iranian force among the Shiites, in the entire war, you know, fighting the whole war and giving them Baghdad, for crying out loud. And so I don't know whether it's a fact, but it sure sounds right to me when the DIA and the CIA accused Chalabi of being an Iranian spy and said that they believe now that the Iranians used Chalabi to dupe the neoconservatives and lure them into war with Saddam Hussein to overthrow his government, because they knew that they would be the ones in the catbird seat. They would be the ones who get to decide how things go. And of course, that's exactly how it went. George Bush and his entire government kicking and screaming and spitting about it and denouncing Iran for 8 years straight as they fought a war on behalf of Iran and Iran's cat's paw factions in Iraq. Damn, that was going to be one of my questions for Eric Margolies, too. Is it possible that Obama wants to actually go ahead and continue backing these guys and try to undo Bush's policy of giving Baghdad to the Shiites? Maybe Obama is so pro-Israel that he's willing to keep backing ISIS, not just in Israel, but maybe even wants to support them. Or I don't know, I guess as long as everybody keeps fighting, they don't really care. But it seems like, you know, Bush's policy of fighting for the Shiites wasn't really his idea. It was the Shiites' idea, and it was a fait accompli for them once he did their dirty work and invaded. But that would be the aberration in the region, right? The other policies of containing Saddam and Iran are consistent with Saudi and Israeli policy there. Seems like would be more consistent with Houston's policy.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. And man, I'm so disappointed in Rand Paul. Not that I'm surprised at all. If you don't know the story, I interviewed Rand Paul. I was so excited to interview Rand Paul. I didn't know anything about how to talk. Or about Rand Paul, other than he was Ron Paul's son. And I guess right around this time, 2009, I interviewed him. I was so damned embarrassed. I thought, you know what, maybe he just wasn't prepared. And I thought about doing the right thing, being a nice guy, and burying the interview and not publishing it. I thought, this guy's freaking horrible. How is he horrible on everything? He's so wishy-washy on everything. Oh, I'm so disappointed. And boy, when the Rompaulians hear this, they're going to be disappointed. And I publish a thing. What am I going to do? Not publish this? So I publish a thing. And I determine then, never mind, you know, my personal opinion of him as a person or whatever kind of thing, but just my political judgment of him is that his political judgment is centered around winning more than anything else and far more than anything else. He's willing to compromise any principle for power. So at that point, I don't give a damn what your last name is. And it was easy enough for me to predict then, and I did. And boy, did I have to get in 10 million fights on Facebook about it and all this crap. About how, look, the fact that this guy sucks on Guantanamo implies quite certainly that he's going to keep sucking on a great many things for a very long time. And when you look to him for the example of the one great senator who's going to stand up for what's right on this, that, or the other thing, he's going to disappoint you at least half the time, if not more than that. Which, you know, that's such a big deal to me, not because, hey, whatever, hey, you know, I'm comparing him to all other Republican politicians, but I'm comparing him to Ron Paul, who, as I've said many times, I learned this, too. I don't know why I ever, it's not like I ever really doubted, but I finally realized that instead of going, ooh, 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 Ron Paul's on CNN. Ron Paul's being interviewed on cable TV news. Ooh, I wonder what he's saying. And going and turning on the TV, that I realized that I'm not that excited about it anymore to hear what he's going to say because I know it's going to be good. And if I know what the issue of the day is and what they're interviewing him about, I know what he's going to say. And I get that whole, why was I excited in the first place to see Ron Paul on TV? For the vicarious thrill of knowing that a bunch of American, you know, politically interested American types are about to hear someone give a reasonable and peaceful position on a major issue. It's going to be good. He never lets me down. He gets up there and he goes, well, you know, the first thing is stop killing people. And then maybe you can save Medicare, or whatever his thing is. He's great on everything. He's Ron Paul is a person. Thank goodness no longer a politician. But he's a person that, you know, regardless of his faults, I recognize what his faults are and where his positions differ than mine and that kind of thing. But still, he's a person that you can rely on to get especially the most important issues right. And so, and you know what? What the hell do I know about becoming a senator? I guess nothing. Who's the senator? Rand Paul has passed the market test, and he's shown that he's doing good. He sucks up to the libertarians a bit, but the libertarians are still a minority in the Republican Party. The Republican Party is still mostly Jacksonian, not Jeffersonian. And so he's perfectly happy to throw them all the red meat in the world in order to get elected. He's trying to walk the line and be everything to everyone. And I think what's going to happen, I could be wrong about this, maybe everybody loves that kind of crap. Everything to everyone. It seems to me much more likely that he'll be nothing to nobody. Because let's face it, the hawk base of the Republican Party is not the Jacksonian rank and file right of the Republican Party. It's the military-industrial complex. It's the vested interests. Oil and banking and arms manufacturers. And as we've seen in Ukraine, agribusiness. So he's got to win them over, not just the bloodthirst of the average right-wing rank-and-file voter. And they're never going to have confidence in him for the same reason so many libertarians want to have confidence in him, his last name. He'll never be reliably bloodthirsty enough for them. And so what does he tell the Iowa Post or whatever it is this weekend? I'm open to bombing Iraq. You're open to it? Who does that satisfy? It's not going to satisfy Jennifer Rubin. And it sure as hell is not going to satisfy any self-respecting libertarian. And here's the thing of it, man. Here's why this is so disappointing. It's not because who he's the son of. It's because the reality of the world of the year 2014. Rand Paul could be the greatest peace leader in American history right now.
It could be Rand Paul against the Empire. Hillary Clinton wants to start running right now? Then let's have Rand start running right now. And let's have a real fight, a real choice between Republican Empire. Go ahead, lead. You'd be right. You'd win, maybe. And you know, it's the same thing with Ron Paul's campaign. Ron Paul, I think, understood, but his campaign people just never could understand that it was okay if the people didn't necessarily agree with him on peace or the Federal Reserve. It was important, it was most important that he was leading America on these issues. You know what's the number one problem in America? War and central banking tied for first place. So Ron Paul said, I'm going to change the world. Blam, watch, everybody. You could be a right-wing Protestant Christian Republican congressman and be as anti-war as hell. Watch me. And they went, wow, cool. I don't have to be Michael Moore, a big, fat, multi-millionaire, commie hypocrite to be for peace. I don't have to be stupid Susan Sarandon to be for peace. I can be Ron Paul. Thank you, Ron Paul. That's why I got more military donations, more donations from military members than all other candidates combined. Double Obama and all the rest of the Republicans combined. Because they said, blam, a patriot for peace. Here we go. Thank you. Same thing on central banking. Everybody said, the Federal Reserve, that's boring and stupid and wonky and nobody cares about that. And Ron Paul said, well, you should. And he led the way on that. And if he had had... if he'd been surrounded by people who understood that Ron Paul, and I mean in 08 and in 012, if he had understood that he is leading the way on this, that he is changing, he is flipping the script on everybody. He doesn't need to run to the right in the primary. He needs to run to the libertarian in the everything and lead America. Hey, America, you know what Romney and Obama and McCain and all these guys are bad on? Central banking and war. And you know what you all need to be good on? Central banking and war. Peace in our time. Vote Paul. And Rand Paul could get it right and start getting it right now. And instead, what do we got? Well, I'm open to bombing. Open to bombing.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Hey guys and gals, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. I'm at scotthorton.org. I need to do better with the self-promotion. ScottHorton.org, ScottHorton.org, ScottHorton.org. You can find all my interview archives there. You can find the whole show archives there. You can find my blog there. You can find a bunch of collected documentaries that I like and I'd have you look at. You can join up the chat room during the show at ScottHorton.org/chat. You can patronize all my sponsors in the right-hand margin there at ScottHorton.org and all the pages within. I got a new bookstore that... man, I think it's about half done. I hope maybe more than half done, actually. What did Dave say? There's about 300 of them in there now. I did all the monkey work myself, too. That's at scotthorton.org/books. That's the beginning of all of my recommended reading. Everything I've ever read and can think of that I want to recommend to you. And everything that I wish I'd read, but that maybe I can make some money if you want to read it. And you click the link there. Help make Amazon some money from my bookstore at scotthorton.org/books. That is not comprehensive. I'm still... basically, I've done everything from a list that I made up for antiwar.com a few years ago. And then plus a few more. And then... but I haven't even begun to go through my own bookshelf of everything that I've missed and forgotten and whatever. I have a whole... well, obviously... a whole Afghanistan section, a whole Iraq section, and a torture section, and a more World War II stuff. And anyway, who knows? ScottHorton.org/books. Go crazy. Buy a bunch of books from there.
if you want. I don't know. So that's my website, scotthorton.org. And yeah, I'm here Monday through Friday from noon to 3 Eastern on the Liberty Radio Network at libertyradionetwork.com and lrn.fm. I think the URL should be libertyradionetwork.com. That way it says what it is right in the URL. lrn.fm is easier to say, but it's not as easy to comprehend as Liberty Radio Network. Three things. LibertyRadioNetwork.com. And it forwards on to LRN.FM, so there you go. It's just fine, either way. Great. And then, yeah. So let me say real quick that Casey Kasem died, and I can't say I like top 40 music, but I can say that when I was a young kid, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 or somewhere around there, maybe 8. I think he was the first voice on the radio where it piqued my interest enough that, you know, who are the humans on the other side of these microphones saying the things that they say, and what kind of job might that be to have? And I guess I don't think it was a never-ending trajectory from there on that I would be into radio, but, you know, I think that was, he was probably the first DJ that got me interested in, you know, what all that's about. Being on the radio. I like it. So anyway, it's too bad that he's dead. He was good at radio. And if you ever heard that Chemical Brothers thing of him having a temper tantrum, it's pretty funny. It's like the outtakes of his show. Oh, anyway, so there you go. Casey Kasem died. Great radio guy. J.J. Pavone. Remember, we talked with J.J. and Jessica on the show. Really more Jessica because the whole... two people on the phone line thing wasn't really working out on their end very much. But anyway, remember, they are both in the U.S. Air Force, and I believe both of them flew missions for the Joint Special Operations Command. And I interviewed them. Sheldon Richman, our friend, the most libertarian man in America, introduced me to them. And I interviewed them here on the show. They're both, because of Ron Paul, they became peaceniks. And became Rothbardians and very anti-war and decided to file to be conscientious objectors and get out of the military. Well, JJ, the husband, has been declined for his conscientious objector status. I was informed this morning by Sheldon. So I don't know what's going to happen next for them. I wish them a lot of luck. I don't know if there's a way to appeal that or what. I mean, what the hell? If he refuses to fly, then they can just put him in jail. They can't really make him fly a plane, right? I guess they can make him sit in a brig. And I don't know what that really portends for. It's Jessica, right? Or Jennifer? Oh, man, I'm sorry, guys. I think it's Jessica. Anyway, I don't know what that pretends. I mean, her case is an entirely separate case, right? So maybe she will still get her conscientious objector status. Maybe not. But anyway, best to them. I miss Ron Paul on the kind of public stage. They still interview him every once in a while. I guess I helped convince him, although I not that it really mattered. But I chimed in with the people who were pushing him to run for government, run for president again in 2012. I sort of wish that maybe we hadn't, and he had just gone ahead and let the boy run and lose once, and then he could have stayed in the House for another few terms anyway. He'd just become chairman of the House Monetary Policy Committee and everything. And then big tactical mistake, and I understand because... Hey, you know, it costs money to put these things together, but making the Ron Paul channel a paid subscription channel was a huge mistake. Because after all, if you monetize on Google ads, on YouTube ads, then you don't pick the ads anyway. So you're not really compromised by whoever's advertising on your Google, you know, your YouTube thing. And they could have made probably more money if they just made the entire channel free and the only revenue they raised was off of their Google ads. Because, and I don't know what their numbers are. I don't have any Alexa analysis for you or anything like that. But I have to assume, I mean, for me, and I love Ron Paul. I worship Ron Paul, but I let my subscription lapse there. $10 a month, and I wasn't really watching it. And yet, on the other hand, if all those YouTubes were free, then they would have each and every one of them been viral and would have probably, I have to assume, would have made more money on a strictly libertarian businessman dollars and cents kind of position. I have to imagine they would have made more revenue off of YouTube ads by just making it free and getting them out there and viral to the world this whole time and keeping Ron Paul at the forefront of the public imagination rather than making it subscription only. So, but I don't know. I mean, they had to make their money. The guys who put that thing together put a lot of capital into it. You could tell. I mean, them cameras ain't free. The studio space isn't free. But it just, if I'm a good judge of kind of social media thoroughness or whatever the hell, it don't seem like any of those things go viral at all anywhere at all. It seems like Ron Paul is basically taking a back seat in the public debate, unfortunately. Because he's really the best out of all these people who get national news coverage. By far, on almost all these issues. And certainly, you know, he wrote a thing for the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity saying, haven't we done enough to the Iraqis? Just stop. Just knock it off. And, you know, I absolutely agree with that, too. And again, if you've been listening to the show, I've been among the most paranoid about the danger of these ISIS guys blowing back to the West and the strength of their gains in the Middle East and all that. But I still think that absolute and total non-intervention on the part of the U.S. is the best policy. Because I think one of the major things, I don't know if this would be true in all cases, and look, I'm not for the existence of the U.S. government in all cases, but still, even if I was, even if I was for the national security state, I would still say our best security here is provided by non-intervention. Because we just make the bad guys look right every time we intervene over there. And they're so horrible that lucky for us, I think they destroy their own credibility everywhere they go. Those that would really threaten the United States being the kooks of al-Nusra and ISIS. The more suicide bombery among them.
Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. And Islamists have killed 50 in Kenya, some during a World Cup screening here. From Reuters, Somali-linked Islamists have killed at least 50 people in a Kenyan coastal town, executing men in front of their families and killing others who had gathered to watch World Cup soccer on television. The Al-Shabaab group said on Monday that its commandos launched Sunday night's strike on Mpeketoni, because Kenya had sent its forces to Somalia and accused Nairobi of assassinating Muslim scholars, the charge Kenyan officials have denied. Kenya is now officially a war zone, and any such tourists visiting the country do so at their own peril, it said, after staging the biggest assault since its gunmen attacked Nairobi's Westgate shopping mall in September, leaving 67 dead. Mpeketoni, I guess, where shells of buildings smoldered and pools of blood congealed on the streets, is not normally a stopover for foreign visitors on Kenya's popular coast, but the attack is likely to hurt further an already struggling tourist industry. Western nations have in recent weeks tightened their warnings about travel to Kenya, which has been hit by a spate of recent gun attacks and bombings in Nairobi and around the main port of Mombasa, though none have been as serious as Sunday's. The attackers were so many and were all armed with guns. They entered the video hall where we were watching a World Cup match and shot indiscriminately at us, Meshack Kamani told Reuters. adding that about 10 people were killed there. They targeted only men, but I was lucky. I escaped by hiding behind the door, he said. And anyway, then they blew up some more people. It goes on. So there you go. More blowback from American intervention in Somalia. It's funny to read Jeremy Scahill's book about, dirty wars, about the CIA and mostly JSOC and their secret wars around. And he talks about their history in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia in that book. And, you know, I don't know, man. Who the hell am I to question it? The way Scahill puts it across, and he's a critical eye, is that these guys really believe in their mission. They're hunting down Al-Qaeda guys and killing them. I guess deciding, you know, really which countries they ought to be backing which forces in and why and all that, that's above their pay grade, right? That's some pointy-headed think tank guy's job to, you know, decide. But when it comes to the actual Delta Force raiders and whatever, they actually, I think it's possible, they actually think they're out there fighting terrorism. Scahill seems to take it for granted that, you know, of all the CIA and all the, maybe not for granted, maybe that's not the right word for it. He seems to be convinced that of all the CIA and all the military special operations guys that he's talked to, that their goal in life is killing Al-Qaeda guys, man. They're just trying to keep us safe from these Al-Qaeda guys. And then Scahill's criticism is severe and thorough, but it doesn't go beyond these guys' method for killing Al-Qaeda guys seems to be counterproductive and seems to be, you know, pretty conclusively seems to be creating more enemies. The question of empire isn't really broached in the whole damn book. And I don't know whether Scahill didn't ask any of these guys, like, hey, do you ever think, like, maybe you guys are the Imperial Stormtroopers rather than the Rebel Alliance? That ever occurred to you, huh? It's just kind of taken for granted that, yeah, I mean, we're dealing with the consequences of having an empire, but whether just sowing instability as grounds for further intervention is not really brought up. And I think mostly probably because it's irrelevant. I think there's probably something to that. But then again, I think, yeah, you know, I don't know. And you look at Megan O'Sullivan, for example, who helped run the Iraq War. I saw her on the BBC the other day talking about, huh, what, us, me, responsible? Nah, I don't know what you're talking about. Well, she ran the whole damn war. For the State Department, anyway. I mean, she ran for years and years. She was the czar of the Iraq War. She didn't actually court that much publicity. But still, she played a very powerful role. But to me, she's just some nitwit. Oh, she's the expert. Come on. It's the same kind of thing. You look at the entire neocon movement, Bush, Cheney, and the rest of them. Their number one principle in life, which it took them years to finally learn better than, was that the army can do anything. If the president can will a thing, the most mighty force of might in the world can make it his way. Sunni, Shia, this militia or that one, who could dare to resist the awesome might of the U.S. Marine Corps and its unlimited budget? Which makes sense if you don't know anything about living on Earth and if you really think that every solution just simply has a military problem. No one ever questioned the Marines' ability to put firepower on targets. The question was whether they have their ability to pick targets or whether using them to overthrow this government or that one will really be a good idea in the end. And you look at Somalia, it's the perfect microcosm of this. And Scahill shows it better than anyone in the world. And I think he actually does a better job in his article, Blowback in Somalia, of boiling it down in a real digestible kind of form than he does in the book. But it's in the book, too. But certainly if you... And it's kind of long on personal narrative, but okay, well, he went to Somalia, so let him write about going there. But when you really get to the story he's telling, is that after September 11th, the warlords, including Adid's son, Adid the bad guy from Black Hawk Down, supposedly, The warlords told the CIA, give us money, we'll fight Islamists. And so the CIA gave them money to fight Islamists. And then that really pissed off a lot of people because these guys were sick, evil warlords. And they weren't just fighting Islamists. They were fighting for their own selves, their own power and influence and authority. Oh, well, collateral damage, right? Except that they ended up turning the entire population of the country against them. And by 2000, that was starting in, 2002, late 01, beginning 02. And the more that the people of Somalia resisted these warlords, the more the CIA backed them. Until finally, the Somalis created the Islamic Courts Union, which was an alliance of 13 groups in order to come together to form really a state, in order just to be powerful enough to kick these warlords out. And they were, and they did. And they kicked them out, drove them across the border into Ethiopia. And the smallest and youngest and least important, least influential group in this union of 13 groups was the youth, Al-Shabaab. And yet, Christmas 2006... the U.S. backed an Ethiopian invasion of Mogadishu and of Somalia, and they overthrew the Islamic Courts Union, and they caused a war, which lasted, well, for the first 2 years of it anyway. Then the Bush administration was out of time. In 2008, they cut a deal, and they said, okay, we're leaving. The Ethiopians are leaving because Al-Shabaab kicked their ass. The youth were the ones who grabbed the rifles and fought the fight, no surprise, and beat the Ethiopians and drove them out of the country. And then so Condoleezza Rice cut a deal with the elders, and as Jeremy Scahill reveals in his book, Dirty Wars, on page 222, they basically always did, or at least they claimed after the fact, they always did mean to keep the actual leaders of the Islamic Courts Union. They just wanted it to be in the form of their government rather than the Islamic Courts Union. So they kept Sheikh Sharif and a couple of these other guys. They just want to take them down a few pegs by, of course, destroying the entire society with this horrible war. And then came a horrible famine in 2010 and 11, which combined with the American-caused war led to the starvation of 250,000 people, 260,000 people, of course, most of them women and children, most of them children under 5 years old. Died in that famine. And the same famine hit Ethiopia, and the same famine hit the rest of the Horn of Africa. But of course, it hit Somalia the hardest because of the American war there. And the U.S. has, ever since the Ethiopians left, not long after that, they supported the so-called African Union forces of Uganda, Burundi, and Kenya to invade. And Ethiopia has reinvaded twice now. They've gotten all these people killed, and there still is no real government in Mogadishu that rules the country at all. Al-Shabaab has been driven out of the cities, but as Francis Nesbitt, an expert on this region, pointed out on the show, when the Kenyans kicked them out of Kismayo in 2012, it made them more dependent on Saudi money, and they therefore had to tailor their message and their movement to be more of an international movement. And now here they are blowing back on the Kenyans in Kenya today.